Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And today on the show, we got Jason Vio. Grammy-winning guitarist Jason Vio joins us. Very exciting. I've been trying to have him on the show for a couple of years. I think he won the Grammy in 2016. It was a big moment for us as classical guitarists. We should all have celebrated that moment. It's really something when one of us gets up there on the world stage. And he really is one of us. He really does sound like one of us, and getting to know him felt pretty good. He's a nice guy. And he was gracious to do this interview, even though we were doing it on his phone, and you know, there was an issue with Zoom. And you'll hear that. As far as the other two episodes that I've done online with Urosh and Matthew McAllister, we were able to make it sound good because they had sophisticated recording equipment on their end. They sent me the WAV file. I spliced it into the Logic thing I have here and lined it up, and it worked pretty well. It was relatively easy to do. With Jason, it's the first one I've done where he's on the phone. So as much as the phone works for some things, it works here. It's just the only problem is we were having a delay issue. There was like an internet connectivity issue. So he would say something and then I would say, we'd be a little off. And I would just have to sort of, it was hard for me as an interview because I would have to wait until he was completely done talking and there was like a space to start talking, or there would be a, oh, what were you saying? Sort of a situation. And we didn't, you know, it didn't always sync up. And then it like literally stopped working in the middle of the interview and we had to pick it back up. But other than that, it's fun. And you definitely get to hear from him, and, you know, and he's a very important player. So it's great. I like the fact that this internet-only sort of parameter that we're given gives me access to more players. All three of the people we've had on the show are not planning on coming to New York anytime soon. So, you know, that's the way it goes. We've also, I need to tell you that we're sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. You can go out there, tell them Brett sent you, and get the guitar of your dreams from Richard Sage at Savage, S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. We're also sponsored by rosettapodcast.com/insider. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider. Make sure you put the slash insider on there. And they will give you a subscription for as little as $8 a month to be able to learn the language of your choice. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider to help out the show. You know, I just want to say this. You may notice that we don't have a third sponsor this week. You know, Encoda isn't sponsoring the show right now. They said they're not sponsoring anybody else. So that you know, that seems to be the case. I didn't want you to read anything into them not supporting the show after last week's episode where I, you know, made a big sort of stand in support of the Black Lives Matter movement and just want to make it clear that there's always been a distance between me and Donald Trump, and there's definitely a distance between this show and Donald Trump supporters, I would hope. You know, we find his rhetoric hate, not only hateful, but harmful to the safety of the people that that we love. So that's something that, you know, I had said last week. I can't imagine that's why Encoda pulled out. You know, it just doesn't seem, I met them and they seem like great guys. So that's not, I don't want you to read anything to it. And I hope you'll still go over there and help them out regardless. So that's the case. I mean, if they, I can't imagine, right? I can't imagine that, you know, a couple of people that made a classical sheet music app are big time Trump supporters in England and just don't understand what everybody's problem is. So, you know, we're going to keep moving ahead with what I said we were going to do. We're going to give half of the proceeds to, that I get from this episode and the last episode are going to go to the Black Lives Matter movement via the NAACP. We're going to be donating to the NAACP, and we're also going to be donating to Integrate NYC. Integrate NYC is a program that is trying to integrate the schools in NYC. We have a problem with schools that are all white and all black here in the city, and they are doing their best to fix it. So those, we're still doing that. And I urge you to go over there and donate yourself. You know, we have to continue to fix this issue. It is not fixed yet. I'm sure that we're all sort of recognizing that there's been a softening media as a result of the softening in the coverage of this issue has occurred. Maybe it's a result of the increase in cases here in the U.S. of the coronavirus in the southern states. Now we're starting to, you know, experiencing that. We're starting to experience that here. But we're not going to let off of this issue until it's actually fixed, and it's not far from fixed. I mean, it's very far from being fixed. So again, please donate to those organizations and donate to the show, and half of your proceeds will go to them and the other half will go to me, and I'm going to spend it on my move. That's right. I moved apartments. Huge, big deal. Last time I moved was 5 years ago, and I had that apartment. I moved in there with an old girlfriend. She left, and I was just sitting around it during this whole COVID thing. It's a basement apartment, and it had its charms. But I needed some sunlight. So I went and I found, after like 3 weeks or a month of searching, the place I settled on, I thought I was settling, and I got here and it's just gorgeous. It's this beautiful top floor apartment in an old building in a different part of Greenpoint, which is the north end of Brooklyn. It's near McGolrick Park, if you want to look that up on your Google Maps. And so it's got this old park near it. You know, once everything opens up again, there's lots of restaurants and bars. If I'm, you know, still into that, I'm kind of over that. I feel like the restaurants and the bars took us for a ride long enough. And now that I've learned how to, you know, cook my own food, and that I have more than three recipes in my wheelhouse, I can fend for myself. Thank you very much. I don't need to buy your $14 cocktails and your $30 enchiladas. It's great. I'm in the living room right now, and you can hear this kind of an echo. It's less treated than the last room was. And there's a beautiful kitchen. Like I said, lots of light. And then my bedroom has a little skyline view. I get to look at the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building as I go to sleep. And all of this for the very affordable price of $1,200 a month, but I still have a roommate. I don't mind having a roommate. I mean, the people without roommates are literally living in rat holes. A friend of mine, that's what she said. She said, like, literal rat holes, like there are rats in it. So, you know, if you want a one-bedroom for something reasonable, for something that someone who doesn't work on Wall Street can afford, this is what you don't get it. It's like 2000 minimum. So anyway, I don't know why I'm going into all this, but that's what's on my mind. My old landlord. Oh, those. Oh my God, guys. I don't know. 5 years. I put up with a lot of their crap, and they withheld my deposit, and I had to go over there and basically get as much money out of them as I could. And I got half the deposit back, a little more than half. I got $100 more than the deposit back. I don't want to give you exact numbers, but basically they kept like, you know, 55% of the deposit, just kept it, and then came up with a lot of dumb reasons why they kept it. But man, it's the first time it's happened to me in New York. So I've had to call 311, and it's just breaking my heart because I didn't like these people, but I learned to like them. You know, they were kind of mean and rude, and I sort of thought maybe it was just a cultural thing, but it was, no, bad. I was stolen from. And so if you've ever been through something like this, it's pretty, you know, you get kind of shaky, don't you? You think like, oh, yeah, yeah. See, a friend tells you something like this happens and you say, you call 311, you know, get a lawyer. To me, it's like, I don't want to hurt anybody. You know what I mean? I don't want to hurt these people. But I know that if I call 311, and I did call 311, and then I kind of froze the case because I was like, God, do I want to do this? Because these people, they don't have any building inspection permits, all that stuff like this. This was all just cash. I know this sounds ridiculous to some of you, but it's just the way I live. All right, I'm a cowboy. And, you know, there's no, I just know that if anybody visited that place, that these guys would just lose so much more than what they're keeping from me. And I told them I was calling and they didn't get back to me. And now I feel like I want to give them another warning. But then I feel like they might consider that harassment. I don't know what to do. So anyway, I'm in the new building and everything's on the books. Everything, you know, the leases have been signed and, you know, this is a very legitimate thing now. So I'm out of that. And I thought about walking away from it, but I thought, you know what? No. These greedy landlords, they've single-handedly, them and the brokers have destroyed this city. I mean, just them. You know? What's the problem with New York? Gentrification? I don't know. Maybe it is. But I think that the big issue is that these landlords are sitting there making it impossible. Gentrification is only, the worst thing about gentrification is that the rents go up and make it impossible for people to live there. But the people who are driving the rents up are people that live there. They're the landlords. And they're greedy little monsters. I'm not saying gentrification isn't an issue, but I'm saying the landlords are the one making it expensive. They're the ones making the decision. And every time we try to cap, you know, put a cap on them, something bad happens. You know, we got rid of broker's fees in New York for 2 weeks, and then they sent a bunch of lobbyists up to this happened like 6 months ago. So there was a time, I've been complaining about brokers for 20 years. There was a time where a broker could not charge a fee to a renter. They had to charge it to the landlord, who is actually who they're working for. And basically, if you don't know what they do, they charge you 1 month's rent. So sometimes you can be in it. Like when you want to move into a place, it can cost you like $10,000 just to get in the door. Now, you know, who's got that kind of money? Assholes got that kind of money. So anyway, you know, that's why the city's being overrun with, you know, just dull bankers. Anyway, I don't want to complain anymore. Is this just me? Am I just becoming an old, lonely New Yorker that complains about rent and takes up, you know, progressive causes? I'm doing what comes natural. Okay, let's get on with it. We've got something important coming up. I'm not feeling too well today either. I don't think I got the thing, but it's hot in here. I turned off all the fans for you guys. I don't quite know what to do with the space yet. It's very pretty. Lots of plants. All right, here's Jason Vio.
Yeah, you know, that's all it is because of my deficiency. I literally have been using my iPhone the last 4 years on the road or everywhere, in planes, hotels, whatever. I stopped bringing a laptop because when the iPhone, in a way, maybe this makes me a little bit tech savvy, because soon as the iPhone got to the point where it was flexible enough to do like PDF scans and you could do basically everything from it, you could draft letters on it and all this kind of like, you know, real form letters and this kind of thing and all those various things you could do on it. I basically was like, oh, great. I don't have to bring a laptop again. I'm done with that. It was just one less thing to worry about, like, you know, dropping or whatever.
Still get so excited when I get to use my phone or my computer to do something like that. I feel kind of a combination of old and young giddiness when I do get to do a scan and send it to a student or to somebody. It's just always the best thing.
It's amazing. Oh, I use the scanner.
I'm amazed by it constantly.
I use the scanner. I use the scanner pretty much every day because I'm taking care of my parents. My mom died in December, and
you're at your dad's house now, right?
I was just there delivering groceries, but like, and I. One of the many positives with COVID is like I couldn't really spend a lot of time with my mother in her last, you know, months, because, you know, that September to December period is so intense.
When did you lose your mother? When did this happen?
It was like this last December. And
that's terrible. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it's okay.
You lost a young guy like you.
I was just using that to illustrate that with COVID, like I'm at their condo like three times a week and going for walks, and he sees the kids. We were playing cornhole, this like in the backyard, you know, and doing stuff. It's like way, like 10 times more than I was able to see, you know, my mom, because when you have, I've got two young kids, and when you're at home, you know, those 2 days, you're roughly at home like two, sometimes 3 days on average a week. Mm-hmm. And because with Curtis, you know, of course I'm flying to Curtis, and then I started using the Curtis trips and connect them to, I would put a concert trip on either side and all that stuff. And you figure out all these ways to maximize the time at home.
Are the kids going to camp, or, I mean, no, they're not going to camp. Camps have all been canceled.
No, I mean, they're just like
send them, or what do you do for the summer?
No, they're going to public school. They're going to regular, you know, they're just regular kids. Like Gabriel going to first grade this year. Evangeline is going to turn 4 in August. And, that's another, I mean, there's actually many positive things that in the last 2 months, of course, I'm sort of living that. But the first month, it was a little bit like, I was totally a fish out of water. I didn't know how to function. I still wanted to go to like a restaurant for lunch or whatever. It was crazy. Yeah. It was, and being with the kids every day for a month was wonderful. But also at the same time, I had to learn like kind of how to do it, and how to shut my type A musician, produce, write. I wrote like 45 minutes of music during that first month, which was great, which was wonderful. And I performed two of those pieces actually on June 6th. But I had a lot of trouble like for that month, like shutting off that part of my brain. It was so trained to create and do things and this kind of thing. And I'm in a much better rhythm now with that. And it's been an amazing experience. Actually, the longer it goes on, it's weird. It's like, there's, you know, of course some good days and bad days, but the more thankful in a way, and of course there's horrible things going on. Right. And we have to my wife is a nurse and she had to go back to work. She's working at a correctional facility because we don't have any income otherwise, you know, because all the concerts are canceled through 2020.
What does she do in general? Is she generally a nurse?
Oh yeah, she worked at Cleveland Clinic for a while and Metro Hospital, which is the Trauma One Hospital in Cleveland.
And she's not working there now. She just is going to the correctional facility to.
Yeah, she. Well, the thing is, like, it got to, you know, within that first month, you know, we of course were really circling the wagons financially and going like, okay, we got to make it. We got to have a plan, as like, you know, most Americans did. And she's like, I'll probably have to go back to work. And she, when it came the time to do it, it's like, okay, this week it'll be, I'll put the resumes in. She got a job offer the day after. It's like a 2 month gig.
Oh God, that's great. That's really good for you, because the concerts are not happening. And especially for, you know, international artists like yourself, that's it.
That's two thirds of my income. I mean, When that wiped out, I started applying to all the arts organizations because we were really, it was scary.
What do you mean arts? Like to do what?
There were private donor grants and stuff through various organizations, and my publicist and my manager were going like, okay, you can sign up for these. Like my manager described it as, in her words, quote, a bloodbath. Like it was like in terms of the arts for anyone that made their living, their primary living performing. I mean, thank God I had, you know, a couple months left of, you know, Curtis and CIM. You know, and we Colin and I also do the online school.
Right.
And then I've been really, and I was, like I said, in the beginning of the podcast, I was really leaning heavily on him for the tech support. Like, well, how do you do this? Like, you know, what is Zoom and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, it was, sorry, I'm just going to.
Now I find that kind of, that's interesting. And I want to kind of know what you learned from Colin, but I find that interesting because I remember many years ago, I want to say like 2010, 2008, 2000, something like that. I remember you were you were promoting your online lessons. Am I right about that? And you were one of the first sort of guitarists who were, you know, kind of far along in your career to do that. Right. You know, most of the people that were doing it were super young, you know.
Right. Well, that was another sort of like wake up call to me technologically as well.
How was your experience doing it back then? At the dawn of Skype.
The dawn of like online, you know, teaching. That was 2011 and 12. Now, ArtistWorks had started, I believe, in 2008.
I'm a little unfamiliar with that. Is ArtistWorks that? Is it online?
Yeah. The parent company is ArtistWorks. And basically how it works, it's nothing like Tonebase at all. It doesn't even resemble even a little bit like Tonebase. What it is Colin, like myself, and then I brought Colin on later because the school exploded and we have like, you know, hundreds of students from dozens of countries around the world.
Right.
But that happened right away when we launched in 2012. And what it is we teach the students just like one to one, like this on a piece that they're working on. We have like a curriculum of like 250 videos in the base curriculum, in the curriculum in the library. The students can bring whatever pieces they want, though. They bring, you know, things like this, and then we teach them just like this.
Right.
You know, but it's not live, which is even better. What people now have discovered about with COVID at the conservatory level is the more advanced, you know, for particularly more advanced students, they like to record their piece, a performance of it, send it on a private link in YouTube. Myself and David Sterevin or Colin Davin, we watch it. And we make our comments back to them. That's basically what we've been doing at ArtistWorks for 8 years. And it works incredibly well because the student can take their best shot at their whatever piece they're working on from the most beginner level piece, like a Carcassi method, you know, a scale or whatever, or anything, you know, that kind of thing in first position, all the way to, you know, Asturias or Sevilla or whatever, what have you, you know, Jose Sonata. And you can send it in and you basically make the comments back and you go back and forth. You just ping pong the videos back and forth. That's what we've been doing at ArtistWorks for 8 years. When they explained that to me, I was like, oh, because when they first called me, I was like, my whole perception of online teaching in 2011 was, yo, man, I don't do like online teaching. I don't do any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's
I don't do Skype lessons. I don't do, right? You know, I had this kind of attitude about it.
Now things have caught up now to where we can actually see each other very clearly and we do feel like there's some sort of a relationship happening.
Right.
You know, but before, I don't know if that was the case in 2011. It seemed
kind of... Oh, no.
Saying he would go back and forth, which is a different dynamic than having to deal with all the technical glitches and stuff that are happening.
Yeah, and I already had the iPhone back then. It was actually pretty good, and I would take it on the road.
Sure was,
yeah. I wouldn't even... Back then, they mailed you a mixer board and a lighting rig and this backdrop right here, which I use now.
It looks great.
I bought a potted plant at Target to make it look a little nicer, and I put a lamp here. This is my ArtistWorks setup right here.
It's perfect.
But back then they mailed all that stuff, and I was like, when the iPhone technology got to the point where you could do them in your hotel room,
right?
And you have little kids, you know, you got young kids. I'm like, it's no disrespect to anybody, but like I was going to offload as much of that stuff to the road as possible.
Right.
So that's what I began doing, for better or worse. I mean, it was like, and I was practicing, you know, I'd do the practicing it all around every day, no matter where I was, and get the repertoire ready, the 8 hours of repertoire every year and all that stuff.
You try to get a different program every year. Is that something you aim for?
I don't really have a program because it's like most of what I do is like concertos. I probably perform like 5 different concertos every year. I do about 3 world premieres a year. All that whole, like, it's a lot of that kind of, I don't even really know how to describe it. It's kind of like it's most of the people I collaborate with are string players and singer, you know, like, or singer, or, you know, or
you might call it like playing to assignment. you know?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's his thing. Like a hired gun for a long, long time. And that's I became really used to that. And I liked it because it was very social. It was like a very social kind of thing. Like,
yeah, that's something
my regular collaborators are some of my best friends, like Escher String Quartet. You know, they're one of the best quartets, you know, in the world. And we met at all these, you know, festivals. Sasha Cook is an incredible singer from the Met, Grammy-winning singer. And it was kind of like you just sort of fall into that stuff. And that's what happened. And I was like, well, I really enjoy all this kind of stuff because you're working with musicians who are really, you know, really very high level of not just way beyond their technical ability, their artistic ability and their expressive capabilities. And that was a real blessing for me. I really enjoyed doing that. I just wanted to stay in there. And I was kind of in this bubble for, I don't know, 10 or so years doing that. But the repertoire, the volume thing, the volume load, when you do what comes with that is, you know, about anywhere from 7 to 9 hours of repertoire a year. And,
wow. And that's, so that's you're just quite a bit.
Yeah. So even before I got married, like we're coming up on our 7th anniversary, Irene and I, and like when we met and she was dating, like she saw all that madness. It was like, you know, just like the insane, you know, time organization of like making sure you got, you know, a minimum of 3 hours of practice a day, no matter where you were. And I'd practice over at my sister-in-law's house. And at the time, and, you know, when you have a get together or whatever, you just kind of grab a half an hour here and there when you could to keep the machine going.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like that is a lot. And so you're saying that the iPhone was sort of instrumental in helping you keep that momentum going after having kids and being on the road so much. And also you're able to connect with the children too while you're out of town.
Yeah, exactly. I got an iPhone because of the kids. So the FaceTime thing. But I mean, just phones in general, it became possible to, like, this 10-year period between like 2010 and 2020 is going to be really, we'll look back on it as like where the phones really became organic, like very organic. They allowed a lot of people, you know, who were incredibly busy to kind of do a lot of that volume and get it, you know, you're sitting on a plane waiting for it to leave the thing, you know, the thing, and you can jam out like 10 emails or whatever, but from the time you sit in your seat or whatever and get them out, you know, get them answered.
There are something that older people can use. You know, they can figure it out. You can show them. It's intuitive. It's just much more intuitive than a computer is. And I think it really changed the game in that sense. And I mean, listen to you're right now. I don't know if they know this, but you are on an iPhone. You said you're on an iPhone 8 right now talking to me.
Yeah, exactly. But again, I just did it because I didn't want to deal with all the mucky muck, you know.
No, I don't like dealing with the mucky muck. But I will say that the same thing happened to me during this COVID thing, is I had to deal with a lot of mucky muck. I never did home recording before. I just never wanted to do it. Every time I tried to do it, they were like, oh, you need to buy another thing. And that was when I was young, and I said, you know what, I'm not going to do this anymore. Now I'm 43, and I did my first home recording in that room right there, and it was I had to learn a lot, and it was such a pain in the butt, and I wouldn't have had time to do it if I wasn't stuck at home.
Right. It's an amazing thing. Exactly. Yeah. Any kind of new technological thing or whatever, any gear that you had to have, I was like, You can't fit the learning, like reading the manual, into your life. I know that sounds probably insane to a lot of people listening to this. So, you know, to me, I was like, okay, in the middle of March, I was like, I should buy one of these things. Again, like my former students who I rely on very heavily, I was like, you should get the Shure MV88. You know, they deal
on
all
this. Is that what Colin's using? MV88?
No, he's got like... He's got some things. he had some things at this June 6th thing. I was like, he had the lighting rig and everything. It was amazing. It was great. No, that's what I mean. You got it. It's like, and you know, I mean, he's a colleague. He's just such an incredible talent. But it's nice having someone like that younger, because they're much more plugged in. I've really gotten you know, more used to using Instagram kind of on my own. Instagram was just something that when I, you know, when my publicist would just do the posting, the reposting, they would say, well, like, do these look good or whatever. And all we really did was just, you know, post where I was next week, you know, week to week, wherever I was playing this, you know, this concerto with this symphony. And then next week, this chamber thing and this solo recital or whatever. And they would just post them.
And that's fine, and that's good and fine. But I think right now, you know, on your posts, people are able to get to know you better. I don't really follow too many guitar posts at all. In the last week, a friend kind of, you know, with everything that's going on, I kind of had checked out, especially because I just was, you know, I just was trying to focus on what my opinions are and trying to figure out what I could do to sort of benefit what I believe needs to be done in this country. So I kind of backed off Instagram because there was too many voices. But yeah, right before that, I was sort of checking in a little bit, and I did see, yeah, people were getting much more personal, and the guitarists that I had always sort of appreciated but kind of felt, yeah, that maybe their posts were more or less just like promos for concerts and releases. It's now I was getting to know them in ways that were being, you know, people were kind of being funny, you know,
yeah,
in the blurbs and stuff like that. And it is
for better or worse.
For better or worse. That's right. Some people I'm like, ouch. Let's talk about, I mean, there's so much to talk about with you. The first time that I had seen your face was in the Naxos release after your GFA win. So I was with Adam Holzman in the late 90s, and I played the Marilyn in one of my recitals, and yours was your album was the piece that was the recording that I used. I think it was, for me, the only recording available, with the exception of his own recording.
Yeah, no, I think that actually, I think I asked Marilyn about that sometime shortly after that time, and I think that was... It was the first commercial recording.
Yeah, it was like the first North American release or something along those lines. And so that was it. And I really liked that whole recording a lot. And why don't you tell me about your experience at that time? I mean, that was a long time. What was it, 95, 97? When was your...
I think it was 96, so we were just full guys. You know, we didn't know.
I mean, it was a long time ago now. Yes.
Yeah. No, the record came out in 96, and that was something I had already made. See, again, I feel so behind on the tech thing now, but it's only because I've got a family and this kind of thing and being in this bubble for a long time. But back then, again, I have to credit my producer at the time. We were students. We were in the same graduation year at Cleveland Institute of Music, Alan Bice, who I then went away from to do the Naxos things and then back with him from 2000 all the way through up to now to the forthcoming Bach Volume 2 record.
Oh, when is that coming out? When is the Bach album?
Well, we'll talk about that a little bit, but I actually have no idea. We have no idea because everything's crazy right now. So, but my last note I recorded on that was a year ago, and it's in the can. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so when we were students, I was a junior, right? I had won the GFA when I was a junior, my bachelor's degree. So he and Jim Bonney, who was a guitarist in the studio I was in studying with John Holmquist, they came over to my, we want to talk to you about something because you're getting ready to go on this tour after winning, you know, that competition. And
and you're a junior, so you are 20 years old or something along those
lines. I was 19 still.
You're
actually
like a little kid.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, and it was like, they came over and they were, you know, it was, you know, they were 20, they're somewhat serious or whatever. Like, we think you should make a CD. And I was like, wow, a CD, you know, that was the medium of the time. And we've done the costs. We've looked up the costs and this kind of thing. And I mean, that's why Alan is the record, sort of the record executive or producer, like extraordinaire that he is now, is because he also started that whole thing while he was a bachelor's student. He didn't wait until he got out of school. He started getting on it like while he was there. making records. And so he said, you should make a record to sell on the tour, which at that time, your listeners under the age of like 35, 30 are going to be like, yeah, okay, whatever. It's not that big deal. But in that time, that was a big deal. Like the fact that I had a CD in 1993 as a bachelor's student was very, I think, considered probably at the time by the rest of the student body as being extremely precocious, to say the least.
They were like, oh, here he comes, waving that shiny CD in our face.
Oh, yeah. So you're a big deal now. Like, you won this competition, so you got to make your own CD. It was only to make money because they all knew, like, I came from a background that there was no money. So he's like, you might as well sell these things. His whole thing was like, he knew I was going to lose money. I was going to lose my scholarship status.
And why? Because you had to go on the tour?
Because when you take a year off of your student loans, mm-hmm. they default the moment you graduate. Mm. So he's like, you might as well try to make some money, a couple thousand dollars on the CD sales during the GFA, so that when you do graduate, because when you graduate, you're going to default on your loans. He was absolutely right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. No, that's the thing. That's the stuff that a lot of people don't really know. It's like that was really going on, and that absolutely happened. And that, of course, I did the whole consolidation thing that you could do back then at the interest rate and all this stuff. I don't know what these guys are doing now. It's incredible what they got to deal with now. Back then, it was a lot easier to pay, pay off. So, yeah, those are just ways to kind of, maximize, you take advantage of the moment. And it was wonderful. That was a very nice CD we made. But then the Naxos one was 96. They came along my senior year. I did the tour, came back. I had a year and a half of school to finish. And Naxos approached me. Norbert approached me. Mm-hmm. And with Klaus, on behalf of I'm forgetting his last name. The president of Naxos. President of Naxos.
Okay.
And Norbert, of course, as he is still today, like producing those CDs, he said that, we want to start this thing. That was the first in this Laureate series.
Yours was the first Laureate? Norbert Kraft Laureate? Oh, okay.
Right. Cool. Exactly. And he said,
I didn't know.
So if you have like the complete... And I didn't really have the complete composer. Like, I couldn't make a complete... Because at the time, they wanted to do these kind of things. They wanted
composer retrospectives or Laureate.
Because they were, in those days, in the CD days, they were a catalog label. Mm-hmm. They were a commercial label. You could get them at a store, but they weren't marketing themselves in the marketplace as, like, artist-oriented. Back then, they didn't want any artist photos on the cover at all. That's why mine doesn't have a cover. And there were several others, like Jeffrey McFadden, Antigone got her picture on, I think.
I think later on they started having covers.
Yeah, I think later on they kind of loosened that up. But mine was the first, and there were like no pictures of the artists on the cover. If anyone ever wonders, like, well, why isn't the picture? It's like that was the policy, because they were a catalog, what they used to call in those days, a catalog label. They were simply cataloging their
composers' works.
Yeah. Right. That was the goal, the whole goal of the thing. And that was
why they were $6 CDs in a time where CDs were going for $18.99.
Exactly. So if our listeners can imagine this time, this is like an early internet time where data entry time, right?
Right.
It all had to do with data entry too. So I took that opportunity and ran with it, but I told him, I was like, I don't have the complete, like, of anyone I wanted to record, you know what I mean? Like, at my disposal right now. So he said,
at that age, you're still, I mean, winner or no winner, at that age, you're still trying things out. You're still wanting, you don't want to spend 2 years playing Ponce.
I was still studying with John Holmquist, and I was still learning how to be a musician and a professional and all that stuff, So they're like, well, if you can come up with a theme. So I was like, well, I know enough like Latin American, South American music to make a CD. They're like, great. But I threw the Kraus on there, the Variations on a Moldavian Hora from the set piece from the GFA that I won in 92, which was already like 3 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, yeah, that'll work. Like Norbert liked it. So I was like, I didn't argue with him. So they, and Kraus liked it. So, so we did that, and that was the first Laureate series.
That has to be very interesting, because I think the Laureate series, it did it or did it not extend beyond the guitar eventually? It did, right?
Or, oh, well, you know, maybe, I don't know. You'd have to ask Norbert about that.
How interesting
I lost track with that after 2000, for honestly, you know.
I really got to talk to Norbert, especially now that I'm doing these remotely, and it won't be so hard to get people as they come through the city, but... I really want to see that, because, again, at the time, and a lot of people aren't going to remember this, but at the time, you would go into a Tower Records, and Naxos was everywhere in the classical section. It was the cheapest version of anything you could get. And, yeah. and it was cheap without compromising necessarily on quality. These were new, all-digital recordings in many cases. So, you know, but to think that the one thing that they would do outside of the catalog repertoire is to go with this Laureate classical guitar series of up and coming, you know.
I think because I was still studying, I think Norbert was like, I'll get this. I think Norbert was like, you know, I'll run that by Kraus or whatever, you know, and then that's how it started. I think they created, I'm wondering, you have to ask Norbert about it. I think they created that because of my deficiencies at 19 and not having the you know, entire works of a composer at my disposal for a whole CD, because it makes sense. I never changed. I was never any different throughout my career. I was never a completist in terms of my concerts. I like a very wide range of stuff in a recital. That's what I like to go to with a piano recital all that stuff started happening in the early 2000s, when people stopped trying to be, chronological and according to genre, and they just put disparate things together and created themes. I was doing that in my concert programs back.
Right, you were thinking actively about how to keep things fresh throughout the various.
It was just I just thought of it as something that was fun, and I thought it was cool because honestly, it was a really sort of dumb thing in my mind. I wanted to make a kind of a side one, side two of an LP. Because of my age or whatever. And I was like,
right.
I think these things go together, even though they're from all these different time periods, because of their disparate genres or disparate countries, styles, whatever. But they are connected in this kind of thing. And I used to make programs. I used to send them to my manager in the late 90s all the time. You do this, this,
check this,
this
program.
Yeah, now that's, it's, I'm not saying I started any kind of like trend, because I'm sure there was like, I'm sure there was 10,000
people
thinking the same thing.
When you were younger, you were more of a vanguard back then. I mean, I remember I was around for that. Let's pick up with that. We were, you know, what I need to do now is, they're saying we have less than a minute, and I think that is because we are recording. So we have to restart the meeting. So this is that little spot I was talking about in the intro where, you know, Zoom kicks us out and we have to go back in because they... Lord knows they need money. But you know who else needs money? SavageClassical.com. Make sure you visit SavageClassical.com and also RosettaPodcast.com/insider. RosettaPodcast.com/insider. Okay, on with the show.
When you're just on this kind of hamster wheel all the time, it's like, you know, when you're on this treadmill. And
is it nice to get off the treadmill for you? I mean, you've been on the treadmill now for 30 years, you know? I mean, this is a long time.
It's been great.
Yeah.
I have to say, it's like I'm just trying to learn as much as I can from it. It's been fantastic, and I'm looking forward to, you know, performing again, because that's kind of my whole thing is like it's never been something I've ever really been able to describe. I love being on stage, not because I want people to see me or to look at me. I love being on stage, like delivering the music, or whatever, in the best thing that I can do, whatever I can do in the weeks of preparation or whatever, getting it ready or whatever it is, or the week of preparation in some cases. Mm-hmm. And then
that instant, that moment of whatever, I got addicted to. I honestly became like kind of, after a long time doing it, that's kind of, in terms of your work style, that's all you really know. So all the planes and the hotels, whatever, everything is sort of ancillary to that because it's all for that function. The only time it started to become where I had to rethink it or where I began to reevaluate it is when I got married and started having kids. And that was a real adjustment, of course. Right. And I would say that was about when Gabriel was born in 2014. That was a huge adjustment for me. And I sometimes I handle it well. And it was like, but sometimes it was difficult, you know, for me. And then I, you know, it's like, the car's a little harder to steer, you know, and then,
right.
And then I'll bring it back or whatever. And it's like, all right, now I got it. I needed a, you know, a couple adjustments that I needed to make or whatever. And now this is like another one, like, for crying out loud. Like, geez Louise, it's like, and it, you know, and then parents taking care of your parents or whatever. It's all happening at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's been the biggest challenge for me, is that it's all sort of happening at the same time, right after, just after the point where it was like, you know, 2011 was Curtis, 2012 was the online school, 2013 marriage, 2014 Gabriel, 2015 the Grammy, 2016 House and Evangeline born. I mean, it's like a blur. I mean, all that stuff started happening. All those additions to like the work life and the daily personal life were all happening like boom, 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 like this. Very little time to make adjustments. And, you know, so, and then
COVID.
Yeah. And then COVID. But it's like, you know, at the end of every day, you're just thankful. You're just thankful that you're not sick. And that's where it sort of brings you back to kind of reality, is like, you just, you know, the only reason all that stuff happened is because I was really busy and I was doing, you know, somebody thought I was doing some good work. That was great.
You just mentioned the Grammy, which is obviously a big moment for all of us, really. You know, whenever I think who are the other guitarists who have won a Grammy for best solo performance?
Some guy named Segovia, some guy named David Williams. Russell, someone named Sharon Isbin. You know, it was great. I mean, those. The names Laurindo Almeida, mm-hmm. those are all like really important. I mean, Laurindo Almeida is an incredibly important guitarist, and those are all the five or six or whatever it was. Julian Bream
did win one. Yes. Okay.
Thank God, that's my guy. Yeah. That's
he's your favorite?
Yeah, of the old guard. David and I are friends, and so he knows, like, he's like my favorite live performer, like, ever. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and Manuel is like right there too. Like, Manuel and David, for me, that generation is like, I mean, Eduardo, David Tannenbaum, like, right. so many, like, those guys are like, Eduardo's a big one for me too. Punk Galbraith, Paul's a big one for me too. We're friends. Those names I just mentioned are really big for me. Bream, for me, I mean, yeah, you know, it's hard to get into this stuff. But Bream, for me, was like the closest thing to a total package for me when I was a kid. You got to remember, when I was a kid growing up in Buffalo, it was like the 80s. So I started classical guitar in 1981. So David hadn't even come to America yet. Manuel hadn't even gotten the major management thing going with the business end of and playing all over the place and all that. You know what I mean? You know, so like, I was born in a really sort of interesting time in that sense in relation to classical guitar, because, well, you know, I loved all those records, but, you know, at that time it was Parkening, Segovia, Williams, and Bream, and then there was a bunch of other great players too. I'm not saying that they're every, you know, I have to, I'm not saying that everybody else, there weren't other great.
No, but we had to go to record stores to get the records. And with that being the case, you were limited, and you had to kind of make really kind of acute decisions about who you were going to listen to outside of the outside of that core four, you know. And it was sort of a and it was also a decision that cost a kid a lot of money, you know. So if exactly. you know, the Vox Box was one of the best deals in town.
Right, your parents had to shell out the money. My teacher Jeremy Sparks, who passed away a couple of years ago, and he was a founding member of the Buffalo Guitar Quartet, and he would go to the public library in downtown Buffalo and bring all this stack of LPs. And he said, "You got to listen to all these people." And I was like, "Why? I like this player or whatever. Well, how they're doing this, whatever." I was 12 or whatever, you know, and I was like, "I don't like this, whatever." You know, when you're 12, you're like, "I like this, I don't like this."
Right.
No, but I think he knew it was important for me to listen to all the different, you know, kind of things. I had a real, you know, I was very headstrong as a preteen and a teenager. And, but I heard a lot of things. And there were a lot of charlatans, of course, back then that were able to, whatever, you know. As an adult, it's kind of the same, but there was a lot less of all of them back then because there wasn't the internet. It was a time before the internet. Our generation, the Gen X generation, is kind of special in that regard, in that we came of age, we became adults before there was the full flowering of the internet. There was only email. There was CompuServe.
Right.
Right?
CompuServe. That's right.
We were in college. You and I were in college. That was it.
Yeah.
It was like you could email someone, and it went through cyberspace.
Yeah. Yeah, and it took a long time for the pictures to come up.
Yeah, pictures.
You know, well, you couldn't just send a picture. No. You know, as far as the Grammy and all that, well, I mean, first of all, your relationship with Bream, you know, do you know him personally? Have you met him a couple of times? Or
He signed a flyer. At Clan Hands Music Hall in Buffalo when I was 14 years old, 1988. Mm-hmm. I never forget it. He played great. And no, on records, what I was going to say was, he was my guy. That was the guy.
And for me, his recordings are so powerful, you know? He's so present. Yeah.
Yeah. Excited. I've gotten better at capturing what I do live. I've gotten better, mm-hmm. I think, at capturing what I do in a live context on an audio recording.
Now, how do you do that? What is your method to capturing the atmosphere and the immediacy of a live recording or a live performance? Because these are performances. I was thinking about that when I was recording earlier. I was going, think about this as a performance, and which perform. And when I'm thinking about takes, I'm like, that's just not a good performance, or this is a better performance.
Yeah, you know, most of them are going to sound. You know, look, honestly, most of them are going to sound a little like flat, yeah, or dry, right, or like kind of afraid to make mistakes. And
yeah,
when I'm on stage, man, I'm not thinking about.
No.
I'm not worried about making mistakes, and as a result, I probably make a couple of mistakes, you know, but. I have to credit my producer with that, because my producer is very much about trying to, you know, capture that without, of course, while, you know, maintaining the industry standard. Like, they're a commercial label, so they have to maintain the industry standard, but I think they do a good job of kind of capturing that live thing. So
they do it. So you're saying that they do that from an engineering standpoint. What do you do? Do you have any method to like making sure that you stay present during a recording?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Engineering and producing is their job. And my job is to play, you know, speaking on their behalf. I think that they would say that their job is to make it as much as possible so that I could just play or play, start at measure 22 and play to measure 23.
Right.
Or, you know, and all that kind of thing. It's all record making at that point. But at that point, it's record making, but they're trying to, you know, they're trying to get this kind of thing where it captures what you would do live. And so, like, for example, the play CD, the Grammy, the one that won the Grammy, and the Bach, whatever, we started, you know, we made a lot of CDs together. Ponce was the first one, then Albanese, then the Pat Metheny. And I'm not even counting the collaboration CDs. I'm just talking about solo ones. and then Matheny, and then Bach. Each time I think we both got better at capturing, you know, this kind of live element. The first Bach record was easy to make compared to the Ponce or the Albanese. I mean, those are much more arduous for me because I was still learning how to be a recording artist, you know. I'm very much a live player, and to rein me in, you know, to rein me into a studio kind of thing, a commercial recording type of aesthetic and all the things that go into it is probably not an easy thing for Alan to do. But, you know, he's a very calm presence, and that's why he's one of the best. And all the string quartets and pianists and orchestras and stuff that have worked with them, I mean, when I meet them on my travels around wherever I'm going, they go, oh, my God, he's wonderful. Wonderful to work with, you know, and golden ear and all that stuff, you know. He's great.
And that play album, I mean, you know, when that won... you know, I hate asking a question like this, but I mean, what was your feeling? I mean, how long did that feeling last? What, you know, I mean, that's an amazing thing to win a Grammy, you know, and it's something that
cool. I made that feeling last as long as I can make it feel.
That's you allowed awesome. It to sink in. You weren't just like, okay, what's next? You kind of took a year, I hope.
I reveled in it as long as I could. And that's all I'm going to say. I just let your imagination run wild. I mean, I just enjoyed it as much as I could, you know, because it's probably never going to happen again. One, I'm a guitar player.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's kind of, you know, it was just wonderful. We couldn't believe, none of us in my inner circle of these, you know, like Alan and Bruce Agree of Azeka Records, that's a two-man operation.
Yeah, they won too, you know.
And it was very, like, kind of like, you know, mom and pop kind of thing. My publicity thing. Like, we just, it was amazing. We couldn't believe it. It was really amazing. I mean, and so, like, getting nominated is, of course, a lot harder, as you probably know, than winning. Because if you win, you're one of five. But getting nominated, you're like one of 400, 500 or whatever entries. So
yeah, and you're up against pianists and violinists. You're up against
major talent.
All the stuff that makes us sort of puts the tail between our legs. All those instruments. Hard. It was a big moment for people like me because you see a guitarist win it, and I know if people, whatever reaction people had to that, the best reaction to me would have been one of feeling inspired and feeling like, again, like, you know, you did connect us to the Herbie Hancock song.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's what, when David Russell, you know, like I said, I'd already kind of, like, he and Maria and I had been friends already. So when he won in 2004 or 5 or whenever that was, I wanted to have a party at my apartment. Yeah. I just wanted to celebrate. It was like, I literally wanted to celebrate it.
Right.
You know, that's just something you just want to close the street off or whatever and have a block party.
Like, and you're like, anybody else classical guitarists here? And no, there's nobody there.
No? Okay, cool. All right.
Just me. Yeah.
Just me. That's cool. Yeah, no, I definitely like it. But it's like, it's kind of like you want to like completely like, you know, have a celebration for like a few days about it. It's awesome. And that was a big, you know, again, for me, he's such a big deal to me. I won't forget. I try not to forget that, you know, I'll never forget, like, seeing him in Rochester, New York, Rochester Guitar Society, John Wiesenthal, president. And, you know, just seeing him at 14, 15 and being in a master class with him, that's like a life-changing event, truly life-changing event. You know, that was great.
Yeah. He's an incredible player. Well, Jason, is there anything else that you want to talk about before we go? We're going to maybe wrap it up a little bit here, but let me know if there's something that you want to promote. I know that you had the concert on Saturday. I'm sorry I didn't make it, but I wanted to make it. Colin had invited me to it. It was a 2:00 Saturday concert, which I'm loving. I'm loving these in-home concerts. It's great not having to go into Manhattan and see things.
I'll just promote things this way. I mean, I don't really, you know... I've got some pieces. I got this thing. It's called Gumroad. It's a platform where you sell music on. We're going to put it on my website. I've got a new, you know, web designer, and he's going to have these things. We got six pieces. Two of them were on that concert. We had a lot of people actually asking about where can I buy this stuff. So we've got those in Score, and we're going to have them also in Tab, actually. Cool. As well. For non-classical guitarists and folks that don't read, we're going to eventually have it in Tab, but we're going to have it in Score within the next week or two.
Gumroad. What's up with that name? Did you come up with that?
Kind of platform that you can kind of sell stuff off of. Okay. And so we're going to, but you could also, I think, embed it into your website is what my web designer is explaining. So we have like two of them up. We're going to have the next four very soon. My engraver tells me within a week. My engraver is an incredible guitarist and musician, Andy Poxon. I think a lot of people know who he is.
When you say your engraver, you mean the person who writes down your arrangements, or
Is there a someone who engraves music? Again, that was something I never found the time to do. Ever, you know, like a lot of people at that time, like 15 years ago, like, oh, you know, guy, well, just, you know, do Sibelius. I was like, I'll try to learn Sibelius sometime. Yes. I was like, I'll try. And it was, there's never any time to like really learn it.
Guitar music is very, I write guitar music. It's very difficult because you have to write it on the same staff. So that having it all be on one staff is not something that comes intuitive to Sibelius, or you can sort of piddle around on a MIDI keyboard. It's not as simple as people think it is. If you're doing different voices on four different staffs, and then you're fine. But us having to cram it all into one thing is something that is much easier to do by pen.
Oh, it's much faster by pen, because especially if you're trying to write a tab version of it. That's what I learned this year. This year was like to try to translate the Matheny things into tab for all the people that need it in tab in order to do it once and not to do it again. You know, you got to make it, you know, it's like the Finale software doesn't understand, you know, a lot. It can't translate the thing that you're doing by music into tab.
Yeah.
So it's.
We'll figure it out.
I'm learning a lot of stuff. It'll take me some time. We got six pieces coming up within 2 weeks or whatever, my stuff. The Bach Volume 2, I'm going to try to find out what's going on with that. I'm kind of without a publicist now for obvious reasons, and we'll see what we, you know, with the COVID and everything, and with the concerts canceled and everything, we'll go from there. We'll see you know, you just have to keep checking back in with me. I'm checking into Instagram and all that stuff personally, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you on there, and, you know, it makes it a much more fun way to get to know you.
Yeah, you can see me playing, like, Mario Kart and stuff. I mean, when is that ever going to happen again?
It'll happen again. I want you to play Mario Kart often. It's a wonderful game to play. All right, Jason, well, it was so good getting to know you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Brett.
That does it for my time with Jason Vio. I hope you enjoyed that. Again, bear with both of us as we deal with this dramatic change doing these interviews remotely. But I really enjoyed getting to know him. He's a real sweetheart, and I'm glad that we're friends now. Please, again, donate to, instead of donating to the show for the next two episodes, please donate to the NAACP. Or Integrate NYC. That's integratenyc.org. And those are the two that I chose. And maybe you know, do whatever you can do too. All right, let's get out there and let's make a change for the better. So thanks a lot.